You are listening to a podcast from the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace.
We're delighted to be able to sponsor and host this event this morning on the topic of migration in the context of economic development, particularly at this time, well, not at this exact moment, because obviously we've lost some of our audience to the financial crisis, but at this time of a U.S. election and a pending change, and perhaps a significant change in the U.S. government, we're happy to host the event in this context because migration, particularly during an election season in the U.S., is so often reduced to very, very narrow economic questions at best, and very typically only to the impact of immigration on Native workers. Or worse, it's reduced to a political rallying point, sometimes encompassing some very destructive and antisocial aspects. That's not at all the way that we think about migration, and we thought it was a good time to step back and to take a very balanced, serious assessment of the issue as a development issue, as well as the impact on the migrants, the sending and receiving societies. This, of course, is an issue not only for those societies, but for the U.S. in terms of its overall economic interests, its global security interests, its stability interests, and it's in that context that we wish to have this discussion. Our first speaker is Professor Robert E.B. Lucas, who is a professor of economics at Boston University. He completed his bachelor's and master's degree at the London School of Economics and received his PhD from MIT. His research has included work on internal and international migration, employment, human resources, income distribution, and intergenerational inequality, international trade and industry, the environment, and sharecropping. In my opinion, Professor Lucas is one of the most comprehensive and balanced thinkers on the topic of migration in its broadest dimensions. He is the author of the 2005 book, International Migration and Economic Development, Lessons from Low-Income Countries, which is a magisterial treatment of the subject. I am delighted that Professor Lucas has agreed to write a Carnegie paper on the topic, which in effect is a condensation and an updating of some of the most important themes. And if you didn't already pick it up, it's on the table outside the door. We're publishing it today. Following Professor Lucas' presentation, we will have comments by Dr. Bruno Loesch. Bruno is a senior economist at the World Bank in the Sustainable Development Department of the African Vice Presidency, where he is in charge of coordination of the so-called Rural Struck Program, which is the structural dimensions of liberalization on agriculture and rural development. It is a program that focuses on the economic and demographic transitions in developing countries. Bruno is also research director at France's CIRAD Research Institute. And also on the table outside, we have a recent paper by Bruno on the subject of migration. In addition, on the table outside, there are copies of the PowerPoint that Professor Lucas will be using this morning. And after his presentation and Bruno's comments, we should have ample time for a very good discussion with all of you. Professor Lucas.
Well, many thanks, Sandra, for the introduction. And thank you, Evelina, who I think is not here, for her help in getting here. And thank you to the Carnegie Endowment for the opportunity to speak today, and to all of you for showing up here in the middle of this exciting economic times, maybe depressing ones. Let me see. I'm going to be using the PowerPoint, so you may want to follow this. Given widening income and demographic gaps, migration pressures will not go away. Migration is not a temporary phenomenon that we should expect to dissipate in the coming years. This is something that's here to stay with us. I think we're all aware that while some countries have grown quite quickly, particularly in East and South Asia, others have suffered declining incomes. As you can see here, Central America, most of Africa and the former Soviet Union all performed quite poorly over the last 15 years or so. Gaps in living standards are widening between countries, and that will continue to contribute to migration pressures. Demographics matter too. There's a famous paper by Tim Hatton and Jeff Williamson, which is called "Where Are All the Africans?" They wondered why there were so few African migrants. I suspect that this is something that's going to change quite rapidly if you look at the combination of the growth record and the demographics over the next few decades. My guess is we're going to see very large numbers of African migrants, probably showing up in Europe in particular. As globalization has proceeded, despite growing economic and demographic gaps between countries, migration has grown less quickly than either international trade or financial flows. There's no inherent reason that migration would necessarily grow at the same speed, but it is often perceived as having outgrown everything else. You see here in this chart, the red columns indicates what's happened to the volume of exports. The green column shows what's happened to the stock of international migrants, which has grown far less quickly. But the stock of migrants in North America, Europe, and the Middle East have grown faster than most. I might note here the dark piece on the top. Or international migrants in the former Soviet bloc, that is something of an artifact. A lot of people were suddenly redefined as international migrants after 1990. They were people who were in different parts of the Soviet Union, were internal migrants, and suddenly were defined as international migrants. The simulated global income gains from expanded migration are very large. There are a couple of exercises that are out there now that suggest that even something on the scale of a 3% expansion in global migration would have a larger impact on world incomes than a total liberalization of all trade. The numbers are extraordinarily large. In that process, the migrants are the big winners. The gaps in incomes and earnings between the countries of origin and countries of destination are so enormous, the migrants manage to make, on average, extremely large gains. And this is true despite the fact that middlemen are creaming off part of the gains to migrants through commercialization of the migration process, through recruiters, smugglers, and fees on remittances. I think it's worth emphasizing that the gains to the migrants are a form of development in their own right when they're originating from developing or transition countries. They are nationals of developing countries, and they are gaining incomes. The net simulated impacts on host countries where migrants are arriving are generally positive but small, though with very large distributional consequences. Some gain while others lose within the immigrant countries. But migration can have very large, important effects on development in the home countries too. And not all of those impacts are positive by any means. It's important to realize that only a few countries have high immigration rates. This is illustrated here in this map, which shows the diaspora of each country as a percent of their home population. So these are stocks of migrants. But the same picture emerges if you look at the flow of migrants over the last 10, 15 years. Most high emigration countries are quite tiny countries. particularly island states. Only five countries in the world with a population of over 5 million have 15% of their population or more abroad. So only a few countries have very large diasporas. Any development effects of migration are therefore very highly concentrated on a few countries, those with high emigration rates. Of the migrants in the high-income countries, about 30% are from other high-income countries. Less than 17% are from low-income countries, even though those low-income countries comprise more than a third of the world's population. So the perception that international migration to the high-income countries is dominated by movement from developing countries is simply false. High-skill migration to the OECD countries is growing very rapidly. The stock of migrants with a tertiary college education in the OECD increased by about 8 million people during the 1990s. The brain drain rates, the fraction of people with college degrees who are leaving these countries, are extraordinarily high from regions like the Caribbean and Central America, from Indochina, East Europe, parts of the Middle East, and almost all of Africa. Of the adults in the OECD countries from low-income countries, about 45% have a tertiary education. So, again, the perception that the low-income countries are sending predominantly low-skilled people is false. This fraction, 45%, is a higher fraction than from the more developed regions. Moreover, the stock of tertiary educated adults from low-income countries grew fastest during the decade of the 1990s. So the proportions from the developing countries with college degrees are high, and they're growing very rapidly. This is a complicated graph, but let me try to bring out a couple of features of it. First of all, most high-skill migrants, you can see that the various columns there are labeled primary, secondary, and college. So the college are the people with college degrees down to those with only primary education. Most of those with college degrees are in North America, especially the U.S. The U.S. has been the end of the brain drain process for quite a while. In Europe, low-skill migrants dominate. So Europe is on the left, North America on the right. Of the low-skill migrants, very few are from low-income countries, either in Europe or in North America. In Europe, the largest group of low-skill migrants are actually from other high-income countries. But this picture, this difference between the U.S. and Europe, is probably beginning to change. During the 1990s, high-skill immigration to North America, the stock of college-educated people grew by about 7%. The stock in Europe grew by 45%. Another indicator and closely related to this is what's happening to students who are heading abroad for college education. Non-OECD students enrolled in European Union universities increased by 55% during the 1990s. So again, rapid growth in study in Europe, and many of those students don't wind up going home. They stay on afterwards. There's been a lot of discussion of whether there is really a brain drain or a brain gain effect at home. Brain gain refers to the idea that perhaps the countries of origin actually gain economically by having high-skilled people outside of their country. We can talk about possible processes, if you like. Both have been claimed that there is a net loss and that there is a net gain for the home countries. But in the end, I think the evidence is very mixed and probably inadequate to tell whether the countries are really losing or gaining from this process. If there is a net loss to the countries at home, what are the policy options? Policy options are at both ends of the chain. For the host countries, those that are attracting the highly skilled, there's been some talk about restraint. I think that this seems very unlikely to actually happen. The UK, for example, said we will cease recruiting of nurses in South Africa. Turned out the number of nurses going to the UK from South Africa didn't go down at all. The UK National Health simply put this out to a recruiting firm who did the recruiting for them instead. There was no serious restraint. There's been discussion of possible compensation. Countries are investing in the education of these people who then leave. It's been discussed, but I don't see any serious progress in making those compensations. I think the real onus is going to fall on the countries of origin if there's going to be any adjustment here. One issue here is in achieving more effective deployment of the highly skilled people in their countries of origin. For example, I just mentioned South African nurses going to Britain. On the other hand, an OECD study looked at nurses in South Africa and found there were 20,000 registered nurses in South Africa who were not working as nurses. They were either maids for high-income families or staying at home and not working at all. So there's a question of whether you're even effectively using these people. It was rather like the term that Graham Hugo, an Australian researcher, came up with for this. He calls this brain overhang, when you have a lot of highly skilled people and you're not using them at all effectively. Another major policy issue I think that's facing many of the developing countries is the mode of financing of higher education. In the US, we rather take it for granted. You're going to have to pay a large part of the fees for yourself. You borrow money to do so. In most developing countries, that is unthinkable at this stage. Indeed, some of the African countries actually have it built into their constitution that you will be have a free education if you get into college. That, I think, will take some very major adjustments if we're to address that. Moving to loans, we're seeing that happening a good deal in Europe now, but certainly in the process, you need to protect the opportunities for low-income families. The policies have to be quite well designed to deal with that. The brain drain may have negative effects at home, but the poverty alleviation is certainly greatest from low-skill circular migration, where low-skill workers go and come home again. That almost certainly results in the greatest amount of poverty alleviation in the countries of origin. Why? This results in high levels of remittances because people are intending to come home, and those remittances reach the poor if it is low-skilled people who are going. Low-skilled workers at home benefit because the pressures on the low-skilled labor market are diminished. Underemployment of the low-skilled people at home is reduced. And there's actually an interesting literature coming out on what is called the returns to returning, we are indeed finding that people who have been abroad and come back have higher productivity when they come home. And this is, the recent evidence is showing this is not merely because you select the brightest people to go in the first place. There really are gains to that experience abroad. Just by way of illustration of this process of low-skill circular migration, this graph shows up until about 2003 the movement of people to the Middle East from South and Southeast Asia. The numbers are gigantic. We don't have reliable stock data. A number of the countries in the Middle East won't release these data. But we suspect there are somewhere around 10 million migrant workers in the Persian Gulf countries. Virtually all of this, or a very large part of it, is low-skill workers moving, and all of it is temporary. It is basically impossible to settle permanently in the Persian Gulf countries. As a result, this shows the official reported remittances per migrant leaving different parts of the world. So that huge column in the middle, marked GCC, are the Gulf Cooperation Council states, the Persian Gulf. So these are temporary, low-skill workers, and they are sending back enormous amounts of money in the process. Low-skill, temporary migration schemes may help poverty at home, but they also present a dilemma. One dilemma is that better integrated migrants with well-articulated rights, especially the right to family accompaniment, are less likely to return home. On the other hand, if the migrants are separated from their family, this produces all kinds of social tensions and effects, possibly at both ends of the chain. Leaving your family, your children at home, we see mothers leaving Sri Lanka, heading for the Persian Gulf for 4 years at a time. That produces enormous strains on their family at home. Having single people who have come to a high-income country, leaving their families behind, knowing that they're only here very temporarily, they have no interest in integrating in the country, again produces social tensions. The other dilemma, of course, is how to manage low-skill migration temporary programs. Though I think some things can be done to help that process of return. There's a lot of discussion now of the need to look into the processes of transferability of pension schemes and Social Security. If you can't claim a pension that you've been contributing to when you go home, there's not very much incentive to go home. Wider use of contracting services may encourage more return. And there's been some discussion of that under the Mode 4 of GATS. And perhaps above all, reducing the cost of re-entry into the country you've come to may well encourage you to return home in the first place. A number of the European countries are now experimenting with multiple entry visas, and they are indeed finding that people who have a multiple entry visa are much more willing to go home. They know they can come back again if they can get a job. The migration of low-skilled workers to low-OECD countries is largely from the neighboring countries. So on this map, you can see the high color areas all are around the OECD countries with only a couple of exceptions. All of the white blanks in there are countries where less than 1% of their low-skilled workers are in the OECD countries. The only distant exceptions on here are countries that have high refugee situations where some of the OECD countries have indeed taken in low-skill refugees. In fact, south-south migration dominates from low-income countries in general, not just of low-skill workers, but more generally. So here you see the four main low-income regions: sub-Saharan Africa, South America, South Asia, East and Southeast Asia. And with each, the purple block is there. There is migration within their own region. So that, for example, the best data we have suggests that of the diaspora from the countries of sub-Saharan Africa, about 70% are in other sub-Saharan African countries. Indeed, those numbers may be an underestimate. South Africa is one of the big magnets within sub-Saharan Africa. The last South African census was quite appalling and clearly way underestimated the number of foreigners in the country. Other things equal, I think most migrants would rather stay home. Yes, you get the very young, enthusiastic people who want to go off and explore the world, but mothers who are leaving their small children behind in Sri Lanka to go off to very uncertain circumstances in the Persian Gulf for 3 or 4 years, I'm pretty sure would rather stay home if they could find a decent income at home. The pressures to emigrate often reflect either a failure to create jobs at home or a failure to maintain security. The emigration option under either of those circumstances provides a critical safety valve, a way of at least obtaining an income when no other options are really there and escaping violence. Low-skill circular migration, even if it is south-south, can alleviate poverty and raise living standards. I think it is less clear that it contributes to growth in living standards. For growth, you would either need investment out of that income or more technical progress. It is less clear that we get either of those, but it clearly does raise living standards. But it may leave pockets of poverty behind. Immigrants typically are highly concentrated, not only by country, but by region within those countries, and even from specific villages within specific regions within those countries. You often find 80-90% of a village has headed abroad, and that village is doing relatively well on money that's coming back. You go to the next door village that never had any migration, and it's far, far poorer. The isolation from the benefits of migration is probably particularly true where internal migration in the country is low. That way, you don't have internal migrants moving in to replace those who've gone abroad from some other part of the country. In the end, though, I think migration should not be seen as a substitute for development at home. In fact, I think there is some, if not considerable, risk of long-term dependence on migration. Countries give up bothering to try to create jobs if they think they can depend on migration to provide those jobs instead. Long-term dependence also introduces risk if there is a sudden cutoff in the option to go abroad. We saw a very sudden return of large numbers of people from the Persian Gulf, for example, during the first Gulf War. And that had a very negative impact on regions like Kerala in India that had sent huge numbers of people. Meanwhile, the policies of the high-income countries are not part of any coherent development strategy. Aid strategies are dreamt up by the aid agencies, sometimes the Foreign Office, trade policies by the trade ministries, migration policies are set by often the internal ministries. And these ministries rarely talk with each other about what this is doing to those developing countries in a coherent framework. There is competition to attract the highly skilled, which may be damaging the low-income countries. And there is certainly part of this is working through competition to attract students, and we're seeing new countries getting into this game. Countries like Japan and Singapore are now competing quite actively, trying to attract high-skilled students to come to them. Meanwhile, the industrialized countries protect low-skill sectors, especially agriculture. All of the industrialized countries spend huge amounts of money protecting the agricultural sector, which in most countries is actually the dominant employer of low-skill migrant workers. So they're trying to attract high-skill workers, yet protecting the low-skill sectors that employ these people. And low-skill migration is only from their neighbors. So to sum up, managing a mutual interest in return migration and achieving greater policy coherence will probably require some regional partnerships between countries. I think the prospects of reaching any kind of global agreement are dim at best. But such partnerships with the high-income countries will isolate the lowest-income countries, which are not tied in to this migration process. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Professor Lucas, for giving us such a broad and such a rich overview of these issues. Now we'll turn to Dr. Loesch, who will give a commentary and I suspect bring in some of his own research on this topic, and then we will open for discussion. Bruno.
Thank you, Sandra. And thank you to give me the opportunity to provide comments on Robert Lucas' paper, which offers a bright update and a broad perspective on international migration today. I am not myself a migration specialist. In fact, I was more involved in migration issues through works on which I am involved today about economic transition and all the structural transformation processes which are related to the more global globalization process. So I will just start. I, of course, agree with the main issues raised by Robert Lucas. In passing, I only want to point one issue of disagreement, which relates to the deep mechanisms of migration. I don't think, as you say in your paper, that the dominant restraint on international migration is a reluctance to relocate. Of course, when you can stay at home, you do it. But I believe that improving the living conditions for oneself, family, and the future of children is a very strong driver of migration and has always been a strong driver for migration. It started on the Neolithic times, and it still works today. And this country is clearly the best example of what these broad processes means. I will focus my comments on three main points and will adopt a broad historical perspective on this issue of international migration. I think first that we need to keep in mind that migrations have been in the past part of the broad process of economic transformation or economic transition from a core of agricultural activities toward industry and services. It is clearly the main historical pathway for development. Increasing productivity in agriculture allows labor and capital transfers to other activities. This process is, of course, accompanied by progressive spatial shifts, spatial restructuring with migration of labor from country to cities, which translated historically in urbanization, which clearly helped the industrialization process. In this process, which started in Europe, international migrations have clearly played a major role. The pace of rural depopulation in the 19th century in Europe was clearly bigger than the new labor opportunities provided by the rapid industrialization of European countries. And migrations were a clear exit option for many countries. We need to keep in mind that between 1850 and the 1920s, around 60 million Europeans were involved in the what some scholars called the white migrations and moved toward the new worlds. It was, of course, first the case of the United States with a migration flow of 35 million people, but it was also the case of other regions of the world, particularly South America, Argentina, Brazil, Uruguay, the well-known also Australia, New Zealand, also South Africa, but also the case of Siberia, in the case of Russia, because the colonization of Siberia was a main exit option in the process of change in Russia at the end of the 19th century. Job opportunities and wage gaps were, of course, the main drivers of these migrations, and they remain today. The wage gap was around 2 to 4 in the past. The wage gap today is around 1 to 10. So we have here a pull effect, which is clearly bigger than in the past. As clearly stated by Robert Lucas, migration flows today are clearly concentrated in the peripheral regions of the developed countries. And geography, of course, is a clear determinant and also a clear constraint. Today, the main migration spatial networks are between Mexico, Central America, the Caribbean, and the USA, are between Eastern Europe, Turkey, North Africa, and the EU. And in many of these countries, we can reach, as it was said previously, around 10% of the population living abroad. It's a case, for instance, in Morocco, it's a case of Mexico, which are clearly border countries of the industrialized world. The long-distance migrations from Asian countries to the Gulf countries clearly refer to and illustrates another pattern which is characterized, and it was clearly shown by Robert Lucas, by temporary and strongly controlled migration flows. My second point will address the very specific case of the countries which are today at their early stage in the process of economic transition, and where agriculture still plays the major role in GDP, in trade, and particularly in the labor market. It is clearly the case of the least developed countries, the low-income countries, many of the lower middle-income countries, and it's, of course, particularly the case of sub-Saharan Africa. In these countries today are confronted to the very new context of globalization, which offers, of course, big opportunities, but also which means also clear constraints, particularly the huge productivity and the huge competitiveness gaps between these countries and other parts of the world are a clear risk for these countries regarding the viability of their own transition process, their own economic transition process. In a country like, let's say, Burkina Faso, when you try to develop new industries in a global open economy, and when you face at the same time big competitors like China, you clearly face a big issue. At the same time, when you have 80% of your economically active population engaged, involved in agriculture, and when you know that the global agro-food system is characterized by huge processes toward integration, there is also a risk for these countries to have a significant part of their farmers in a process of marginalization. In this context, in this case, I think that one of the main issues is related to the very few economic alternatives existing for a growing labor force. The consequence is a low regime employment pattern where the informal sector in these countries is rapidly growing and accompanies growing urbanization. Often, in this type of context, the clear exit option appears to be international migration. And we have many images, particularly in sub-Saharan Africa or the border of North Africa, with all these boats people trying to reach the European coasts, which have been part of the news during the last 2 or 3 years. And last and not least, I want to add the fact that we have to put these processes in of economic restructuring in the global perspective of unachieved demographic transitions, because for many of these countries, and because there is a clear relation and correlation between demographic transition and economic transition, in these countries we still face population growth rates which are between 2.5 and 3% per year. It's the case of sub-Saharan Africa. And in these countries, it means that the yearly cohort of people entering the labor market are, for all the sub-Saharan Africa today, 10 million people per year. It will be 20 million people in the 2020s. In that context, the pressure for migration will be huge in the next decades. And if the liberalization of the migration flows occurs, don't occur, many countries will clearly be trapped in a poverty process and become, provocatively said by Alan Pritchard, they could become so-called zombie states. With huge economic, social, and political consequences. My third point relates to Lucas' dilemma. Protection of migrant workers discourage return, as well as the family reunification. I think it's an issue of today. If we put this discussion in perspective with the population prospects, I think that we need to have in mind that several regions of the world will face a population decrease in the next decades with quite big consequences regarding their activity structure and their labor markets. It's by 2050, Chinese population will decrease. It's clearly the consequence of these so radical demographic policies engaged during the last decades. The European population will stagnate, And the consequences of these processes will be the aging of the population, which of course will cost a lot to these economies. And for these two regions, they will clearly face a labor deficit. So at the same time, sub-Saharan Africa population will continue to grow, and the expected population in 2050 will be 1.7 billion people, starting from 700 today. So it's an increase of 1 billion people. So as a conclusion, based on this historical perspective, which I hope will help to kick off our discussion today, I think that after the first age of mass migration, as it was said by Hatton and Williamson, in the late 90s and the first two decades of the 20th century, we could have to deal in the next decades with a second age of mass migration, which could probably unlock the impasses of a globalization process which is restricted today to trade and financial flows. Thank you.
And thank you, Bruno, for adding yet additional dimensions to the already rich discussion. So now we're open for conversation. I will take the prerogative of the chair to pose, maybe I'll just start with one question, and then we'll take sets of questions from you, and each of our speakers can answer as they choose. So for a first question, Professor Lucas talked about the concentration of regional migration within sub-Saharan Africa. I think you said it's on the order of 70% of all migrants in sub-Saharan Africa are in other sub-Saharan African countries, which was even larger than I thought. Given the comments that Bruno has made and that we're all aware of about the earliness of the stage of structural development of many of these countries, my question would be, is there enough differentiation among the countries of sub-Saharan Africa to provide real economic opportunities? Is that the size of the picture that we should be looking at for opportunities for sub-Saharan African would-be migrants, or do we have to look primarily in another context? So that's one question. And I guess the second one would be, Bruno just referred to the demographic transition in China and in Europe, and of course a milder version of it going on in the U.S. And other countries as well. How strong of an impact do you think that will actually have on changing policies toward and realities of migratory flows? And with that, let me allow our speakers to think about those questions for a moment and take questions from you. Yes, Eduardo.
Thanks. I have two questions. The first one is, you said that your first slide is that migration is not a substitute for development. And if we think about the places from where the migrants are coming, we are thinking about a local economy. And it's clear it's not a substitute. There are some studies that show when the remittances are sent, they are not necessarily spent the best way and so on and so forth. And then your solution to migration, or one of your proposals, is to integrate, to have an integrated policy, an integrated approach to migration, but you think, I think you think, more in terms of regional, but a very high level, like among countries. Let's talk about among countries. And isn't there a missing point in which migration is not approached with integrity in a local perspective? Shouldn't we be thinking on how to integrate the fact that people are going to be migrating and coming back to effective policies in their localities so we can actually integrate it into development? That's one question. The second question is more or less between the two. And wouldn't it be, Bruno, I think you contested a little bit the idea that migration, this idea that migration has grown is lower than trade, international trade, despite growing disparities, right, widening gaps. And then you say, well, the problem is that in the countries that are the origin of migration is informality, right? Informality, there is no jobs, so people have to migrate. But are you proposing to find a correlation between the rate of migration and the rate of growth of informality? That's sort of a provocation to discuss how much we can learn about migration flows in terms of origin, speed, so on and so forth, from an economic perspective that looks at rational decisions by individuals.
Do we have another question at this point? Yes, sir.
Thank you. My name is Ralph Watkins. I'm with the U.S. International Trade Commission. What role should the mobility of labor play in the negotiation of trade agreements? Should trade agreements include provisions for mobility of labor? There was a big contrast between, say, the East African community and NAFTA. With NAFTA, you assume that there are going to be the provisions for high-skilled workers, whereas if you look at the East African community, it's fairly easy to get a work permit to go across the border. I was in East Africa a year ago, and I was seeing that there was a lot of weapons coming in from Somalia to Kenya, which increased the crime rate in Nairobi. There were professionals in Nairobi who were going to Arusha in Tanzania to get away from the crime. There were service workers, hotel tourism workers, leaving Kampala in Uganda to work in Nairobi where wages were higher. There were agricultural workers in Rwanda going to Uganda to help harvest the crops. So you had a great deal of mobility of labor, and the East African community regulations, the agreement helped with that. But we don't have that legalization of the mobility of labor under NAFTA.
And may I just add a sub point to that question, and it goes back to Bob Lucas' reference to the Mode 4 negotiations in the WTO. Most of the discussion of Mode 4, which is movement of natural persons as it's defined in the WTO, meaning migration, people moving, to the extent that those discussions have become specific and they're at relatively early stages in the Doha round compared to the more direct trade issues, they have really focused very much on high-skilled labor, on movement of high-skilled workers. And so although it's on the table in a trade negotiation, it's sort of cream of the crop negotiations, the ability to have IT workers or management professionals move across borders. So I would add that for our two speakers to your question. Why don't we pause there and allow maybe first Bob Lucas and then Bruno to respond as they wish to any of those questions, and then we'll take another round.
Do I go first, Paul?
Yes, why don't you?
Gosh, there were good questions there. Just a quick clarification. I don't think Bruno and I have any disagreement, but I think a large part of the driving force behind a lot of the migration is indeed economic opportunities. I don't think we have any disagreement there. What puzzles me and I think a lot of other people in this area is, given the size of the income gaps, why do so few people move? As you've seen, for example, in Europe, opening up to more mobility
I think virtually all the Europeans are shocked by how little migration actually occurred inside the European Union. But that's where I go back to saying, why do so few people move? I think because a lot of people are very reluctant to move. It's nice to stay home if you can make it at home. So I don't think we have any real disagreement there. I'm glad you touched on this issue of the transition from agriculture to industry and how migration ties into that. I would probably see that a little more with internal than with international migration. We're seeing huge migration flows inside China at the moment on a scale the world has hardly seen. People leaving agriculture, moving east, trying to get jobs in the newly expanding sectors. One of my other hats that Sandra mentioned at the beginning there, it's interesting, I'm doing some work on Finland. It's a curious country. If you go back to 1950, Finland was basically a developing country. 70% of the labor force was in agriculture and forestry. It's now a high-tech country. So the transition from one to the other is quite fascinating. And looking at this issue of intergenerational mobility, do rich parents have rich children? Do poor parents have poor children? Turns out that as long as the parents were in agriculture, the children turned out to be pretty much like their parents. If your parents had very little land, you wound up being poor. It was the opening up of industry that broke the lockhold of the family on determining how the children would come out. So migration and the movement into industry played a key role in providing new opportunities for children. Both Bruno and Sandra touched on this issue of negative population growth in differing ways in Europe, China, former Soviet countries. It's tempting to think of migration as a route to thinking about solving the aging problem. It's not going to be a long-run solution. You've either got to bring in increasing numbers of migrants over time, or you're not providing a permanent solution to this, unless the migrants turn out to have much higher birth rates than the natives and that they don't adopt local norms in terms of those birth rates. So it's not obvious that you're providing any kind of long-run solution by bringing in migrants. But will we see a change in policies as a result? I think we're seeing a shift in policies happening in Europe at the moment. It is the European countries that have taken the lead on the Global Development Forum, setting it up. There's a great deal of discussion in Europe at the moment about the whole development implications of migration, a discussion that I hardly see in the US. Just doesn't come up in the policy discussions here. How much of that is being driven by the population issues in Europe is difficult to say, but certainly some of the countries with low population growth rates are amongst the most active in those discussions. Will there be real opportunities within Africa? Some countries have certainly done very well in Africa. One of my favorites is Botswana. I spent some time there about 20 years ago. It's a wonderful country, spectacular economic growth. Will that ever be on a scale to begin to solve the massive problems in Africa? I can't see it. But I'm not sure that migration will be the long-run solution for Africa either. I think that there will be building resistance to migration into Europe from Africa as this swells. I think the problems of development in Africa have to be tackled as development problems in Africa. I don't think migration will be the solution to that. Eduardo raised the issue what are we doing about integrating migration into development thinking and development planning more generally? Very little. I actually just wrote a paper for the ILO on this about what is happening and what can be done. And I was actually shocked. As part of that, I went through not only a number of the high migration countries' development statements, their planning documents, but I also went through the UN documents, the ILO documents, the World Bank's poverty assessment programs, and even in many of the countries that have extremely high migration rates, migration hardly turns up as part of the discussion. Somewhat shockingly, if you look at the planning documents of a country like Lesotho, migration hardly arises. In fact, the main discussion was of immigration and how they should worry about immigration of managers who are coming in with the multinational corporations. So there's a great deal more that can and should be done there. The role of informal employment, it's probably my background working on India a number of years ago, but I'm a big believer in the informal sector. I think in some countries, the informal sector has done a fantastic job of providing employment. If the informal sector in India had not been what it was, India's labor market would have been in massive, massive difficulties. So I'm not sure I see the evolution of an informal sector, certainly not in every country, as being something that's going to drive emigration pressures. Indeed, I see in a country like South Africa, because of the pressures under the apartheid government to resist any kind of informal sector developing, I think that is one of the fundamental things that has driven their massive unemployment problems in South Africa at this stage. Should trade agreements include labor? If you're going to talk about services, trade in services, I think they pretty much have to in some fashion. I think it's a good way of raising the migration perspective by building them into these agreements. On the other hand, I think it's true that of the documents that I know, relatively few of them have very much in there. Agreements like ECOWAS, I think, is an exception in West Africa, where they've clearly opened up documentation and mobility of labor. But I think there's more certainly could be done there. I wasn't quite sure whether you were suggesting that migration increases trade in weapons, increases the... It's certainly not a theme I think I would want to bring out. Certainly critics of immigration like to say immigration causes all kinds of crime and violence. In fact, if you look at the US statistics, the incarceration rates of immigrants are way, way lower than the incarceration rates of US natural-born citizens.
Thank you. About the reluctance to move. No, of course, I think that we agree about the fact that economic opportunities are clearly the main driver. But in the case of the EU, the wage gaps between the old EU countries and the new ones, it's 1 to 2, and perhaps if we take the case of Romania, Bulgaria, it will be 1 to 3. But if you compare with the wage gap between European Union and Sub-Saharan Africa, which in 1 to 10, 1 to 15, there is no way. If there was a possibility for the people to migrate, you would have clearly a huge increase of the migration flow between Sub-Saharan Africa and the European Union and perhaps other parts of the world. So, yeah, we are clearly facing a situation where we have clear constraints to the migration flow, which are directly related to the migration policies implemented by the developed countries at that stage. So you will give me your point after. Regarding another question raised by Sandra about the size of the sub-Saharan African countries and the very little difference, economic differentiation between these countries and the very few economic opportunities in sub-Saharan Africa. I think that clearly for sub-Saharan Africa, one of the main issues and the main options regarding public policies is clearly the development of integration processes between sub-Saharan African countries. From an economic point of view, many sub-Saharan African countries are not viable in the context of a global open economy. And there is clearly a big issue regarding economic integration, because it will be the only way to have economies of scale, which will allow perhaps the development of new activities and to be able to deal in a better way with the huge competition which exists today at the international level. So I think that free trade agreements between African countries and the development of a process of economic and I think also political integration will be one of the main options for the sub-Saharan African countries to deal with the huge increase of their population in the next four decades. About the question raised by Eduardo regarding the informal sector, my remark was more referring to the fact that in the countries which are at the early stage of the economic transition, of the economic transformation process, where agriculture today still employs the major part of the labor force, there are clearly very few economic alternatives and very few other options in terms of activities for the population of these countries, in a context where you have a clearly huge international competition. So in these countries, one of the main issues for the people who can stay in the rural sector is clearly to go and to migrate internally within the country to the cities. But one of the main characteristics of urbanization in Africa is that it has been and it is a low regime urbanization without industrialization. And clearly, the main sector which is able to provide jobs at a huge scale in the process of economic transformation is clearly industry. And in sub-Saharan Africa, there are so many blockades regarding the development of industries which are clearly related to what has been the historical process of the economic insertion of the African continent in the global economy and the context of international competition today, that one of the main options for employment is clearly the informal sector, the urban informal sector, and the informal sector, it's clearly often underemployment, badly paid, with, of course, no protection, and it's often more a logic of survival than a way to kick off a process of economic development. And in that context, when your only option is to sell matches, it was matches two decades ago, now it's phone cards at the traffic lights, when you have the opportunity to go away, to migrate and to go in Europe or in other developed countries, you do it.
Back to you.
Hi, Albert Keidel, China program in the Carnegie Endowment. And I have a couple of questions. I think I had to step out for a minute, and I've heard the topic brought out a couple of times. The first question has to do with, as an East Asian economic specialist, I'm always appalled at how little the challenge of domestic economic development is brought out as a solution to the scale of migration problems that we see even here in North America. And that, looking at Asia again, brings me to the financial sector, where global tendencies in the financial sector seem to work against the kind of national development that we've seen in East Asia work at different stages, going back in Japan's case to the pre-World War II era, and very much in evidence in South Korea and now in mainland China, also in Taiwan, Singapore. So that it seems to me that this focus on migration and it ought to sort of have right up front, this is the result of failure in many cases of development in the world. And that has to have the highest priority. And why is it in that way focused then on the financial sector as something that is in many ways prevented from creating funding for infrastructure that allows what might be an informal sector to actually become more formal by increasing the market size and by restraining some of the unhealthy dimensions of globalization at a country or countries in these stages? And I think you all just mentioned these areas, but how in Asia it's been the national model of economic development and manufacturing, not necessarily as the way to produce or to get consumer goods the cheapest, but to provide a transitional process for your labor force to get through an industrialization or manufacturing-based transition period. And the second point is one that brings me from China as well. The Chinese government has a very strong program restraining out migration. When we have problems in the United States with Chinese boats showing up or with a huge flow of migrants through Latin America from China into the United States, we go and complain to officials in Fujian and Guangdong, where a lot of the migrants come from, because they've been responsible for stemming that flow, which we could never really stem. And this seems to be a function of actually successful development in a phase. So there's a contradiction to my earlier comment that once you get developing, the aspirations or the expectations and the knowledge can develop again in a phase. So is there treatment in the migration studies profession of some of these pressures for migration that come with actual successful development in the countries of origin? Sorry to go on for so long.
Other questions? Yes, in the back.
Hi, my name is Dana Galperin. I work here at Carnegie. I had a question in regards to the ratio between international migration for persecution and war versus for economic opportunities. And I was wondering if in recent past this ratio has changed and if it's likely to change in the future and what impacts that will have on development. Thank you.
Yes, Ashish.
Ashish Prasan, I'm in the South Asia program here. It has been suggested, this notion around that countries of origin for migrants should tax them when they are even working abroad, because as countries of origin which have provided them for, invested in their education and which they are citizens of, they should be getting revenues out of this migratory process. Do you think that has an impact on development in those countries of origin, or is it just a political move in some sense?
Any other questions? No? Then we'll see if our speakers would like to respond to one of those.
A couple of thoughts. Albert. I think you were characterizing something that in the migration literature is known as the migration hump. Yes. It came up around 1990. U.S. Commission on Immigration was working, and there were some background documents developed, and somebody said, what we see is that as countries begin to develop, immigration increases. As they develop further, our immigration goes down again, and this became known as the migration hump. That suggestion was actually accepted by the U.S. Migration Commission without any evidence at all. It was quite remarkable. And it actually has a rather dangerous implication that then entered the development discussion of saying, well, then if we help the lowest income countries to develop, they're all going to flood into the U.S.,
Then the Europeans started talking about, well, we've got to stop these people from coming, so we should threaten these countries. If they can't keep people at home, then we'll cut off their aid, which got to be a very dangerous kind of game. In fact, looking across the across countries, there is no evidence at all to support the migration of help. The pattern of emigration is quite clear. It goes down fairly steadily as you go up in income, and there's no rise in emigration amongst the lower-income countries.
But that's cross-sectional.
Yes.
So that's
now, within countries, the evidence is far too thin to tell, but it may be a partial answer to the point I think Bruno's bringing up. What is it that is keeping the Africans in Africa? I think it is partly financial. It's not cheap moving abroad. Then you may well expect, as you become a little bit financially better off, you may be able to afford that kind of move. I'm skeptical in the end that it is really the immigration policies of the high-income countries that is effectively keeping out very large numbers of people. We see so much irregular migration in all of these countries that I don't think there's very strong evidence that the border patrols and so forth are really the things that are keeping people out. The one element in policy that actually does seem to keep people out is when you go after employers for employing irregular people, but none of these countries seem to be actually willing to enforce those regulations, so it doesn't work. What fraction of the migrants are subject to persecution? It goes up and down. It's very irregular. Went up sharply in the 1990s, breakup of Yugoslavia, Soviet Union. Numbers went up very substantially. And then they've come down again. The vast bulk of officially recognized refugees never show up in the high-income countries. Over 80% of them are in the neighboring developing countries. And of those that make it to the high-income countries, it seems that we are very selective. They tend to be the better educated, better off amongst the refugees in the first place. I was kind of shocked. I was trying to look at the Canadian statistics on this. 45% of refugees admitted over a three-year interval where I could actually get data on Canada, 45% of their refugees actually had college degrees. So they're not taking in the huddled masses amongst the refugees. The tax that you mention, I always think of it as the Bagwati tax. He was the guy who proposed this, I think, in the first place. It was an interesting idea. It was ultimately really shot down from U.S. reality. To collect that tax in the U.S. would have required different collection of tax on the basis of nationality, and that is unconstitutional in the U.S. So it could not be enacted in the U.S., and as a result, that proposal seems to have died.
Ken Dillon, Ciencia Press. I'd like to return to a point that Dr. Lucas made about how if you removed the immigration rules and regulations of the various countries and procedures, that there wouldn't necessarily be a lot more immigration. I must say my own experience as once upon a time a U.S. visa officer at U.S. embassies leads me to think otherwise. And I guess where I would put it is there's terrific pressure, certainly. What I would say is we really don't know the answer to that question. And maybe we could leave it at that for now. It's something we ought to investigate a lot more carefully, perhaps, because perhaps it would be possible to adjust in one way or another. But I think that question really remains up in the air.
Yes.
Thank you. I have, in fact, two questions, perhaps interrelated. First one is to Professor Lucas. I mean, you have mentioned about social unrest in the recipient countries, and mainly, related to the new immigrants. My question is, if we take United States as example, it's a country of immigrants, everybody say. So, is it a human instinct that once you are become citizen of a country, you are protectionist to the new immigrants, or there are far deeper reasons for that? And the second one is, everybody is saying in today's globalized world that opening up competition and competence. If that is so, why the government or the people of the developed world are not accepting new immigrants for competition and for openness and all these things? Thank you.
Another question for this round? Let me add one on while our speakers are thinking about those two. There has been some discussion in the current U.S. presidential debate about the idea of reopening the NAFTA agreement, and perhaps that would happen. One of the key issues that Mexico wanted to negotiate in the original NAFTA negotiations back in the late 80s and early 1990s was precisely the terms of migration and to try to get some improvements in the treatment of migration between Mexico and the U.S., and the U.S. was quite resistant to doing that. Arguably, if the U.S. urges a reopening of NAFTA for its own reasons on labor and environmental provisions, one assumes that Mexico would come back with some of the same objectives that they had. In that negotiation, is there one policy, or are there a handful of policies that actually could make a difference that could be negotiated into a trade agreement like NAFTA? No more questions? Maybe this time we'll turn to Bruno first. If you wish, you don't have to feel compelled to comment on anything.
No, the question related to the attitude of the population toward new immigrants. I think that in a historical perspective, there is always a reluctance of the population, including the population who migrated quite recently, to be reluctant regarding toward the newcomers. It has been the case in this country. All the history of the United States can illustrate the fact that there were always reluctance to the new immigrants. When you take the news from the beginning of the 20th century, you can see a clear position against the migration of German workers or Polish workers. We have got the same in Europe with the different movement of migrations between the two world wars, the migration, for instance, of Polish, Italian in France has been a big issue, and today it's clearly directed to the new waves of migrants. So I think it's something which is quite part of the history of migration.
And I would say, to the extent that we have information on this, and obviously Bob Lucas may know a lot more, but my impression as a non-specialist in this area is that there's no reason to believe or to assert that it is the recent immigrants, the previous generation of immigrants, who are most anti-immigrant. I think that there's no correlation there, or if there is, it may be even lower than the population in general, and that, in fact, what drives the anti-immigrant sentiment is either direct economic competition or a perception of economic competition, which can be manipulated for political purposes. And so it would be whatever group is most likely to be in competition in the precise labor market that the immigrants are coming from, as opposed to people who were immigrants themselves turning against it. Growing up in an immigrant community, I certainly didn't perceive that we were more anti-immigrant than others. If anything, quite the opposite in our community. On the questions, Bob?
First on removing the barriers, I would not disagree. I think we don't know the answers. I wish we did. I'm not even sure methodologically how I would really tackle that. It's a really hard question. On the other hand, I think Gordon Hanson has done some nice work looking at resources put onto the Mexican border and what has that really done in terms of reducing the flow, as best we can estimate it, of irregular migration. And his results suggest that putting in more resources has done almost nothing to reduce the flow. So removing the barriers might increase, but we're not sure by how much. I would not disagree. I think Sandra's absolutely right. There are a couple of nice papers looking at this. Some of it's opinion stuff, asking people county by county, would you like to see more immigration or less immigration? And in those counties where immigrants are low skill, you get the low skill people saying we want to see less migration. And the high skill people all say, yes, migration's fine. They get their gardeners and babysitters. And vice versa, where you've got a lot of high education immigrants, the high education people say we want to see immigration cut back. So the opinion surveys certainly support your idea there. That is an interesting question. If all of these countries are really going after the high education people, and I was intrigued. There was a report by the National Academy of Sciences last year or the year before, which they debated what should be the U.S. strategy on attracting high-skilled migrants. And their bottom line was we should get all the best people we can possibly get from everywhere in the world. And they only spent about 5 minutes even discussing the implications for the developing countries of what that would do. So we're seeing all the high-income countries trying to compete for all the high-skilled people. Now, why? The highly educated people here don't want highly educated people competing with them. I ran a little workshop at BU, and I was shocked. I actually had to close the doors. Mathematicians flooding in from MIT across the river, complaining bitterly about the enormous number of Russian mathematicians we'd let into the country. How can you do this? So who wants all these highly educated people? The highly educated people having low-skill migrants might make a lot more sense. You've got people to do your gardening, your babysitting, you get more time to earn income, you get those services more cheaply, yet the pressures are for highly educated people. I think it's not just economic issues that are driving this. I think it's a lot of it is people saying, what kind of neighbors do I want to live next door to? And I think a lot of that reaction is being driven by social reactions and not purely by the economic responses. Albert's trying to jump in on
great.
Two-fingered intervention. We have to include in those politically relevant forces the employers for whom more competition means lower cost. And so I wonder if that's a factor. I mean, they may not be great in number, but in spoken voices, but in terms of paid speech, they often are quite vocal.
You actually see employer pressure at both ends of the chain. I mentioned migration from Mexico is reality, and I don't think there's very much you can do about it. If you'll excuse the language, an English geographer put this rather nicely. He said, we've had an integrated labor market of Mexican workers working in the U.S. for well over 100 years. He said, some silly bugger drew a national boundary through the middle of the labor market. That it's a reality, and in the end, I don't think there's a whole lot you can do about it. I would suspect they're trying to regularize this rather than sweeping it under the carpet and having people here with very little protection or rights or anything else. Maybe a lot neater way to go on that. Why are we seeing such enormous numbers coming now in the 1990s? Mexico's economy has been a disaster. Their average growth for over the last 25 years, I think it's about 0.5% average growth over the last 25 years. It's something quite important, certainly under 1%. McGavin, why are you seeing these numbers? If there were more development at home in Mexico, then I think we'd see that migration pressure being reduced. Agriculture and some of the other low-skill protected sectors, the employers in those sectors are big resistors to any constraints on immigration of low-skilled people as well. So employers are certainly a key to driving a great deal of what we see in terms of the migration policies. Mexico and NAFTA, I'm honestly not sure.
Any last questions or comments from the audience? Comments are welcome as well. If not, let me ask you to join me in thanking our two panelists for their generous time.